this lecture, entitled Heresy, Hatred, and the Destruction of the Second Temple, is dedicated to the honor and merit of the Hirschfuss family. In the previous lectures, we traced the history of idolatry and its role in the destruction of the Bais Rishon, the First Temple. According to the Gemara in Yoma and Tesom at Beis 9b, the Second Temple was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam, ungrounded or gratuitous hatred. The impression is that the Second Beis Hamikdash, like the first, would be still functioning had we not sinned. The impression is also that unlike the First Temple, the people were on a much higher level had it not been for the Sinas Chinam, ungrounded or gratuitous hatred. The material that we'll be covering in this lecture seriously challenges both impressions. At the end of this lecture, I'd like to offer a different explanation as to the role of the Sinas Chinam, ungrounded or gratuitous hatred, that was commonplace in the Second Temple period, and its role in the destruction of the Second Temple. Now, to begin with, it is important to note that the Second Temple seems to have been doomed to destruction from its inception, as we now read from the following passage from Masechta Nozer. The subject discussed in Mishnah Nozer was regarding the proper grounds for annulment of one's vows, and the Mishnah quotes a real-life incident that just prior to the destruction of the Second Temple, several people had taken upon themselves to become Nazirim, Nazirites. And there's a discussion whether the destruction that occurred after the vow would be grounds for annulment. For had they been aware of the foretold destruction, they would have never made such a vow, since the vows can only be completed with the bringing of sacrifices to the temple. Without bringing these sacrifices, these men would still remain Nazirim, i.e., forbidden for the rest of their lives to cut their hair, to come in contact, says, with a dead body, even in the same room, or to consume wine or any other grape products. We now quote Rav Yosef's opinion that the destruction was predicted, and therefore, Rav Yosef maintained, had this man had been aware of this bit of knowledge, the person who made this, or these men who made the vow, they would have never made such a vow. And that's really is on the first page here. Rav Yosef said, had I been there, I should have said to them, is it not written? And he quotes a verse in Jeremiah, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these, which points to destruction of the first and second temples. In other words, they expound from the fact is that it's repeated three times that there are three temples. And the second temple, well, is only temporary. So the Gemara's response is, granted that they knew it would be destroyed. Did they know that so when this would occur? You would assume that having the knowledge would be destroyed, but they see everything is fine up until now. There wouldn't be reason for them to suspect this. Abaye objected. And did they not know when? Is it not written in quotes of Pasuk from Daniel? This is chapter 9. 70 weeks, I mean, the weeks over here mean 70 periods of 7, are determined upon your people and upon the holy city. So if that's the case, this is that they knew, in other words, from these 7 times 70, that there would only be 490 years, this is the Gemara's understanding of the Pasuk of Daniel, there would be 490 years from the destruction of the first temple to the destruction of the second temple, and it had already been predicted by Daniel. So again, so the question is, from the Mishnah it seems that the consensus was they did not have grounds for annulment and they had to remain Nazirim the rest of their lives because they cannot bring the korbanos, the sacrifices, to release them from their vow. But they couldn't go through the process of just, annulment, through a beis din to say that there were grounds that it never was valid in the first place. That they could not do. Because of this. Right, they could not do this. And they say, but... So he's asking, why not? had they known, this pasuk in Daniel says they would have never made their vow. So the Gemara's response is all the same. Did they know on which day? They would have assumed that, again, since there was no inkling that this was going to happen, and there was no inkling that it was going to happen in their mind, they probably still would have made the neder, assuming that people are optimists generally. It's okay. It says, I'll be able to do it within the time. And of course, by the time they came, it was all over. It's evident from this Gemara that it was already predestined that the second temple would be destroyed. Let us now examine the verse in the book of Daniel, which the Gemara quotes first, and we're going to quote the Malbim, one of the foremost biblical commentators who explains this verse. Again, 70 periods of seven, Shavuyim Shivim, are decreed upon your people and upon your holy city to finish the transgression and put an end to sin and to atone for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to put the seal upon the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy place. And the Malbim here on page 2 explains as follows. 70 periods of seven are decreed upon your people. The angel, this is the angel who spoke to Daniel, informed him that the decree that Israel shall be in exile for a period of 70 years was equal to the 70 Shemitah sabbatical years which they violated. For the 70 years were to atone for the sin of violating the Shemitos, you know, the sabbatical year, as it says in Scripture. Then shall the land enjoy rest and enjoy her Sabbaths. Similarly, it says at the end of Chronicles 2, chapter 36, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths. For as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. The land was left fallow and was not worked. Thus, the purpose of this exile was to atone for the sin of the Shemitos. But they were also guilty of transgressing other commandments during those years. In other words, they sinned throughout the entire period of 7 times 70. In other words, once in those 7 years, they violated Shemitah. But they had the other years, they also violated other things, in addition to Shemitah, which comes out to be 490 years. There was no need, however, for them to be exiled to atone for the other sins. Rather, they bore other punishments during the entire period of the Second Temple, as they were subjugated under the rule of three kingdoms, first under the Persians, afterwards under the Greeks, and later under the Romans. All of them pressed down the yoke of oppression upon them. This was in order to atone for the other sins which they did during those 490 years. So this really explains why the Second Temple period was marked with suffering. And he continues on, it has already been made clear that the period of the Second Temple was not a fulfillment of the awaited redemption. For the exile began from the time of the first exile during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar and will continue until the destined redemption. The return of Israel during the Second Temple period and their residence in the land of Israel was considered all part of this exile, as there were no prophets, divine presence, Urim v'Tumim, which is on the breastplate, a king from the Davidic dynasty, nor any ingathering of the lost and cast away. For during this entire period, they were cast away and scattered even more than before throughout the lands adjacent to the seas, as is known from the history of the period. This period of 490 years was conditional, however, for if they would repent sincerely, then the redemption would come about. Or this is before the Cates, or I mean, either at the end of 490 years, you know, or if they really did shuv, even before that, before the Cates, the allotted time at the end of the days. If they didn't merit, however, then the night would darken even more, and they wouldn't return until the hidden end. So there was a tentative end, 490 years. to atone for their sins, and had they really done tshuva, it would be the end of, they would be atoned at the end of 490 years, that probably if they would have done extraordinary tshuva, you know, it would have been even before. But if they didn't do tshuva, which it seems they didn't, then it would just continue on. This is what the angel informed Daniel. There was a decree of 70 periods of seven to finish the transgression, i.e. to atone for the transgressions between man and his fellow man, and the sins against God, and to atone for iniquity, i.e. the sins brought about through a distortion of the intellect and heresy, which is the sin of idolatry. And quote, and to put an end to sin, i.e., end quote, and i.e., the sins created through lust, such as the sins of immorality, which they were guilty of during the first temple period. And he quotes again, he's just quoting the verses, parts of the verse to explain them, to bring in everlasting righteousness, end quote. For if they had repented during this period, then the redemption would have occurred at the end of 490 years, which have brought about an everlasting righteousness. For then all of mankind would recognize the true faith and would lead righteous, law-abiding lives. And further, he says, and to put the seal upon the vision and prophecy, again, he's quoting from the verse, i.e., then the prophecies of all of the prophets would be fulfilled in the vision which they all saw regarding the future redemption. All of them would thus receive the official stamp of the king, the stamp of Emes. You know, that's the Chesomish HaKadosh Baruch Hu, his seal, his stamp, is the word Emes, truth. In addition, scripture is saying that prophecy will return once again, as it says, and it quotes opposing Joel, in chapter 3, and shall come to pass afterwards that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams, means the chalom, the dreams are referring to prophetic dreams. Your young men shall see visions. And he continues on the prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place, which is the end of that verse, is referring to the third temple, which will be anointed by a prophet, as anointing is indicative of immense sanctity. This is in contrast to the second temple, which was not anointed, as it was missing five things, for it was destined to be destroyed. Consequently, the decree of only 490 years was contingent upon their being worthy. Yet a longer punishment and a severe exile was put in place if they would not become worthy. Rabbi Yitzchak Abravanel has already explained that after the future redemption, eternal righteousness for all mankind would come, as they would recognize a true faith. This, however, would need a much longer time period to bring this about than the previous exiles. So this is how the Malbim explains the verse. That really the second temple was really only a temporary temple, and it was only meant to last for that period. In other words, according to the tradition of the Talmud, that the second temple lasted 420 years. So you had 70 years of the exile from Babylon, you know, from Israel to Babylon, the reconstruction of the temple at the end of 70 years, and then another 420 years, Sachakol, some total of 490 years. That's the 490 years. And had they not sinned or whatever, done what they've done, then what would have happened would be that there would have been a third temple. That's in other words, had the Jews not sinned during the period of the second temple, the second temple would still have come to an end, having been immediately replaced by a permanent structure, the third temple, thus ushering in the period of Mashiach. In other words, according to the Malbim, the second temple and the period under foreign rule were meant to act as an atonement for all of the sins of the first temple. Since they had not done so, then they were forced to go into exile to complete the atonement. From the following quote from the Gemara in Yoma in 9b, we also become aware of the inferior temporary status of the second temple. And here is, we're quoting on paragraph, this is on paragraph C. Rabbi Yochanan said to Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, this is on Yumas and Tesomet Beis and 9b, even if they had all come up in the time of Ezra, the divine presence would not have rested over the second temple. For it is written, and he quotes a source, Yaftel Akim Liefes, God shall enlarge, make great Yefes, and he shall dwell in the tents of shame. That means, although has enlarged Yefes, the divine presence rests only in the tents of shame. What? Well, the word Yefes is the proper thing, but the word Yaft means enlarge. So Yaft Elikim Liefes means it'll expand. So what he's alluding to is that the second temple was built through the monies and through the supervision of the Persians. And they are descendants, as that's the Gemara in Yoma, they are descendants from Yefes. Since they built the temple, as they were responsible for building the temple, the divine presence will not rest in them. Only Bo'ele Shem, in the tents that is solely built by Shem. That is the drusha that's inherent in these words. So Rabbi Yochanan, again, from a different angle, said the temple was never meant, this sounds, to be like the first temple or the third, last, the final temple. The weight of the cumulative sins during this period took its toll, and by the end of this period, there are already signs that this period was in its last stages. As we read here, we have several quotes here. This is the first quote is from the Gemara and Yoma, Yoma's Lama Tesom and Base 39b. Our rabbis taught, during the last 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the lock, in other words, one of the parts of the avoda, the ritual on Yom Kippur, is that the two goats are taken, which are virtually alike, and there's a lock placed. There are two cards, whatever, who are made out of wood, whatever. But one is written Lashem. One of those goats is going to be used on the temple, on the altar. And one says Lazozel. One is going to be to cast all the sins over the mountain. The Kohen would put his hands, in the not seeing which one was which, and would draw them. If the lot which is LaHashem, which is the higher one, is on the right side, it was indicative that it's an auspicious time of rachamim, of divine compassion. However, if the right one came out, only the left one came out LaHashem, the right one says, tell LaZozel is going to be thrust over the mountain, says that was a sign really of the strong one will be of judgment, which is the kind of Lazozel. So it says that during the last 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the lot for the Lord, Lashem, did not come up in the right hand. And there was another thing they had that they wanted to know, the people wanted to know, did they really get an atonement from the goat, the scapegoat, the goat that went over the mountain. So they would tied the goat originally with a crimson string. They would take half of that string, and put it, was the question where they put it, but they put it into the temple so they could see. At the end, says if they would get an atonement, the crimson thread miraculously would turn white. It was a nes, and it was a sign to them they've achieved atonement. The last 40 years, says, nor did the crimson colored strap become white, as it did not turn. They did not get an atonement. Nor did the westernmost light shine. You know, the Ner Maravi, the question what exact which one it is, but that the of the seven lamps, the one which is called the Western lamp, it would be given as like all the other lamps, a night's worth of oil. In the morning, generally, says all of the lamps would have been extinguished already. They would have used up all of the oil. When the Jews were worthy, miraculously, one of them did not become extinguished. It just went the whole day, and at night it had to be extinguished and to be replaced. And it was a sign that the Gemara says in Shabbos, in Sechta Shabbos, Chov Beis on Beis 22b, Edus hu l'chol boye olam, it's a testimony to all who come to the world, Shashchina sheyer b'Yisrael, the divine presence rests amongst the Jewish people. So this is that sign of approval, so to speak, that I'm here, was not in the last 40 years. I mean, these were all signs that the end is coming. You are not worthy. And the doors of the Heichal, of the sanctuary, would open by themselves, as if to say that the enemy might as well come in already. Until Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai rebuked them, saying, Heichal, Heichal, like, you know, sanctuary, sanctuary. Why will you be the alarmer yourself? I know about you that you will be destroyed, for Zechariah ben Iddo has already prophesied concerning you. Open your doors, O to Levonon. Levonon is an expression, according to Chazal, for the temple. This is that the fire may devour your cedars. Rabbi Yisrael Tabloy said, why is the name called Levonon? Why is a temple called Levonon? Because it makes white, Levon, the sins of Israel. In other words, his interpretation is not referring to the mountainous area north of Israel, Lebanon, but rather it's referring to the Beis HaMikdash. And he says, I know, he says, it's going to happen. I mean, again, the temple was never made to be permanent. But he saw that in this last 40-year period, it was already going downhill. Now, let's see further on. This is number two here, section D. Mishiroba Ritzkonim. When murder, this is taken from the Gemara, the Mishnah in Sota. Mem Zayinu Medal from 47a. When murders multiply, the ceremony Egla Rufa, breaking the heifer's neck, was discontinued. Because the whole idea was we don't know who the identity of the murderer. Here, if we know the identity of the murderer, I mean, we have a good, but we can't do anything about it because it's a law and order has the corruption has broken down society and broken down the whole idea of law and order, that the whole idea was this is preliminary part for the Bezin to go after to find the murderer, and even if they knew the murderer, they can't do anything. That was when Eliezer ben Dinai, called Techina ben Perisha, appeared. He was after renamed son of the murderer. But this fellow, who was evidently connected also with the revolutionary movement that finally the Biryonim were these so-called, these independent fighters, the zealots, whatever, are all part of this general movement to rebel against the Romans. He was part of that movement, as has been denied. But he was also a murderer. What?
Is he mentioned
as Pinchas? This is a mission Soita, not Elazar ben Dinai. You know, Elazar ben Dinai is mentioned in the Medrash, where it says, we touch upon previous lectures, there were various oaths that were made that the Jews should not rebel in a situation where they're in Golus, to accept it and to do tshuva, rather than rebel. And it cites four occasions that they violated this oath, or these oaths, and they suffered because of it. Twice in Egypt. Once, evidently, there was an attempted revolution or rebellion in the time of Amram. We have no other source besides this Medrash. We have no details about this. Once, it seems 30 years before the actual Exodus, there was a whole group from Ephraim that broke out from Egypt and went up the coast. And they were all killed by the Philistines. The third occasion was, and it quotes Eliezer ben Dinai. Evidently he was part of that movement to undermine the Romans and to gain independence. And we see what happened in the aftermath, the whole destruction of the temple and destruction of masses of people. And the fourth was Ben Koziva Bar Kokhba. Also the thing of independence. Now, I'm going to quote now, regarding this is Eliezer ben Dinai, from the works of Josephus. Now, there arose, this is taken from his, he wrote four works. He wrote a very long work detailing in his mind the history of the Jews up until the destruction of the temple. He called this, it's called Kadmonios Antiquities. So he writes the following. Now there arose a quarrel between the Samaritans and the Jews on the occasion following. It was a custom of the Galileans, when they came to the holy city in Yerushalayim at the festivals, to take their journeys through the country of the Samaritans. And at this time there lay in the road, they took a village that was called Genea, which was situated in the limits of Samaria and the great plain, where certain persons thereto belonging fought with the Galileans and killed a great many of them. So in other words, the Samaritans had attacked the Galileans, these are Jews, who came down south to go to Jerusalem. But when the principals of the Galileans were informed of what had been done, they came to Cumanus. This Cumanus, or Ventidius Cumanus, was the Roman procurator, or the official Roman representative to Judea from the years 48 of the Common Era to the year 52. So they came, really he was the representative. He was the governor of that area. And desired him to avenge the murder of those who were killed. But he was induced by the Samaritans with money to do nothing in the matter. Upon which the Galileans were much displeased and persuaded the multitude of the Jews to betake themselves to arms and to regain their liberty, saying that slavery was in itself a bitter thing, but that when it was joined with direct injuries, it was perfectly intolerable. And when their principal men endeavored to pacify them and promised to endeavor to persuade Cumanus to avenge those that were killed, they would not hearken to them, but took their weapons and entreated the assistance of Eliezer, the son of Dinias, a robber who had many years made his abode in the mountains, with which assistance they plundered many villages of the Samaritans. When Cumanus heard of this action of theirs, he took the band of Sebasti. Sebasti was where Shomron was, with four regiments of footmen, and armed the Samaritans, and marched out against the Jews, and caught them, and slew many of them, and took a great number of them alive. Whereupon those that were the most eminent persons at Yerushalayim, and that both in regard to the respect that was paid them, and the families they were of, as soon as they saw to what height things were gone, put on sackcloth and heaped ashes upon their heads, and by all possible means besought the seditious and persuaded them that they would set before their eyes the utter subversion of their country, the conflagration of their temple, and the slavery of themselves, their wives and children, which would be the consequence of what they were doing, and would alter their minds, and would alter their minds, would cast, and he asked them to alter them, to change their mind, would cast away their weapons, and for the future be quiet and return to their own homes. These persuasion of theirs prevailed upon them. So the people dispersed themselves, and the robbers went away again to their places of strength. And after this time, all Judea was overrun with robberies. This is how he describes the situation as it was in Yehuda. Okay, this happened to be within the last 40 years. After the reign of Cumanus, who was dismissed, by the way, for the general breakdown of law and order, you know, and for having let the situation, meaning the Jews and Samaritans, to get out of hand, Antonius Felix was appointed in his place. He reigned between the years 52 and 60. Regarding his reign, we read in Josephus, number 4 on page 4. Now, as for the affairs of the Jews, they grew worse and worse continually, for the country was again filled with robbers and impostors who deluded the multitude. I mean, the impostors, those who claimed that they were the Messiah. Yet did Felix catch and put to death many of those impostors every day, together with the robbers. He also caught Eleazar, the son of Dinai, who had gotten together a company of robbers. And this he did by treachery, for he gave him assurance that he should suffer no harm, and thereby persuaded him to come to him. But when he came, he bound him and sent him to Rome. And furthermore, we read in Josephus' work entitled The Jewish War, that's his first work, says, this Felix took Eleazar, the arch-robber, and many of that were with him alive, when they had ravaged the country for 20 years together, and sent them to Rome. But as to the number of the robbers whom he caused to be crucified, and of those who were caught amongst them, and whom he brought to punishment, they were a multitude not to be enumerated. When the country was purged of these, there sprang up another sort of robbers in Jerusalem, which were called Sicarii, who slew men in the daytime, in the midst of the city. This they did chiefly at the festivals, when they mingled among themselves among the multitude, and concealed daggers under their garments, with which they stabbed those who were their enemies. And when any fell down dead, the murderers became part of those that had indignation against them. Like, who did this? You know, they pretended that they were angry at this. By which means they appeared persons of such reputation that they could by no means be discovered. If you notice, they didn't have metal detectors then. Yeah. The first man who was slain by them was Yonas Jonathan, the high priest, after whose death many were slain every day. While the fear men were in of being so served was more afflicting than the calamity itself. And while everybody expected death every hour, as men do in war, so men were obliged to look before them and to take notice of their enemies at a great distance, nor if their friends were coming to them, durst they trust them any longer. But in the midst of their suspicions and guarding themselves, they were slain. Such was the celerity of the plotters against them, and so cunning was their contrivance.
To what extent, since we know Josephus...
Josephus lived during that time.
To what extent do we rely on his...
Yeah, if this is an eyewitness report, you know, it was copied, it was written, it was copied and copied, evidently he's not going to write something that's clearly, that is going to be assailed, is going to be critiqued by people who were there. You know, so there's an assumption that the person's writing a history of well-known facts. It's not something behind scenes. You could say there's one's opinion or another opinion. You assume this is what happened. But things had gotten out of hand even before the events that Josephus recorded. For already in the year 30 of the Common Era, years before Cumanus and Felix, there was such a breakdown in law and order under the Romans that the Sanhedrin felt duty-bound to permanently leave its designated room in the temple compound an exile itself to a place some distance away on the Temple Mount called Chanuyos, the place of the stores, as they were only empowered to adjudicate capital crimes as long as they were situated on the grounds of the Holy Temple. In other words, if they were, so to speak, part of the temple and the Shechina and the wisdom that comes with it, so they were allowed to practice capital, you know, the punishment. This move nullified not only their power to try capital cases, but also the power of the entire lower court system to prosecute murders, or anyone for that matter, accused of committing a capital crime. So 40 years before the temple was destroyed, they ceased prosecuting capital crimes. Since murder was so common, and under Roman rule, the Jewish courts of law were so ineffectual, this move freed them from any responsibility to try murder cases and carry out death sentences. As we now read here on page 5 and number 6. 40 years, this is taken from Gemara and Avodah Zorah, Chesom and Beis 8b. 40 years before the temple was destroyed, the Sanhedrin abandoned the temple and held its sittings in Chanus. Has this any legal bearing? Like, what did they, is the Gemara just trying to explain itself? It says historically they left. It says, but what, why? I mean, what legal bearing does it have? Said Reb Yitzchak Bar Avdimi, it indicates that from that time onward, they did not deal with capital cases. Why? Because when the Sanhedrin saw that the murders were so prevalent that they could not see proper, and they could not be properly dealt with judicially, they said, rather let us be exiled from place to place than pronounce them guilty of capital offenses. That's where it is written, it says, because they couldn't carry it out. And as even if they would find the person, I mean, it was such a situation that their hands were tied. And you shall do according to the rulings which they of that place, which the Lord shall choose, shall tell you. In other words, the Sanhedrin had a specific place. Mokom Shivchar Hashem was where the temple was, which implies that it is the place that matters. They have to be in that place. They have to be connected to the Shechina, so to speak.
What does it mean that they could not handle it? I mean, they couldn't properly handle it. What does that mean?
It was because they could not, these people, they could not, because of their influence and because of this, even if they had grounds to convict them, they couldn't carry it out.
They were afraid?
Yeah, they're afraid. I mean, it was such a breakdown. It was an impossible situation. So instead of, you know, on the books we do it, but they were ineffectual. It says, you know, we're going to stop the whole thing. We're not going to make a charade of this. So they stopped totally. Not only was there a breakdown in law and order, morally they sank to new levels. As we now read here, number 7. When adulterers multiplied, the ceremony of the bitter water of the sota, you know, the suspected adulteress, was discontinued. And it was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai who discontinued it. As it says, he quotes a pasuk that the whole idea of the husband who sees that his wife is suspected of immorality, you know, having an affair, that whole process of going to the temple is assuming that the husband himself is a tzaddik, is a very moral, upright person. But if he himself is not upright, there's a whole breakdown of morality even for the husband, or he sees in his own family, he doesn't do anything, as he's passive about the breakdown of morality, the miracle doesn't occur for such a husband. So therefore he discontinued the whole thing. Again, it shouldn't be a charade. I will not punish your daughters when they commit immoral acts, nor your brides when they commit adultery, for they themselves, in other words, the husbands themselves, are guilty. So therefore it was discontinued. In other words, we have no, at least that there is no documentation that this ever occurred in the first temple period. This whole breakdown of law and order, we have no documentation for it. The breakdown of morality. In the light of all of this, how are we to understand the Gemara and Yuma? It says, again, what does the Gemara say? Why was the second temple destroyed? Seeing that in its time they were occupying themselves with Torah, observance of precepts, and the practice of charity. Which you get a sense that, like, everybody's tremendous tzaddik. Because therein prevailed hatred without cause. This teacher, that groundless hatred is considered as of even gravity than all the three sins of idolatry, immorality, and bloodshed together. So you get the sense that, we're going to see this, but these very upright people, and that it seems you get an impression the generation was upright, that the only thing they had was sinas chinam. And sinas chinam, it says, gratuitous, ungrounded hatred, unjustified hatred, was enough of a cause to destroy the temple. Now, if you're quoting all the Gemaras before, you get the impression that things were a lot worse. People were so great. It's gewaltig. I mean, it's akin to say that, look at the Detroit community. There's five koils. They have kosher bakeries, mikvah, the yeshiva katanas. Yeah, it's so great. Yeah, but the entire Jewish community in Detroit, as many tens of thousands, 40,000, 50,000. And the Orthodox community is a very small percentage of that community. So it's true that they have, we're going to give them more numbers. And it's true that it's very fine. But the vast majority is not very fine. Now, in addition, the crime for which they were accused, sinas chinam, ungrounded or gratuitous hatred, seems to be considered by the Gemara in Shabbos in 32b a relatively minor one in comparison to a long list of crimes which finally end with bloodshed, immorality, and adultery, as we now read here. It was taught, this is from the Gemara in Shabbos, it was taught, Rabbi Nechemiah said, as a punishment for causeless hate, strife multiplies in a man's house, his wife miscarries, and his sons and daughters die young. And then there's a list of three or four other crimes, each one of greater magnitude. And finally, through the crime of bloodshed, the temple was destroyed, and the Shekhinah departed from Israel, as written, so you shall not pollute the land wherein you are, for blood, it says, it pollutes the land. And you should not defile the land which you inhabit in the midst which I dwell. Hence, if you do defile it, you will not inhabit it. And I will not dwell in the midst. As a punishment for adultery, incest, idolatry, and non-observance of the years of release of Shemitah and Jubilee and Yovel, exile comes to the world. They, the Jews, are exiled, and others come and dwell in their place. And it keeps on. And it keeps on going in detail about the Churban that will come destruction. From that Gemara and Shabbos, it seems Sinas Chinam is a relatively minor crime compared to this crime. So how would you understand this Gemara in the light of the Gemara and Yom? So again, in the light of all that we quoted, the causes that brought about the destruction of the Second Temple seem quite obvious. Why then do the Gemara and Yoma see fit to attribute its destruction to Sinas Chinam, which seems to be a relatively minor crime in light of all that happened during the Second Temple period? At this point, I would like to dwell upon the impression that the level of dedication to Torah that the members of the Second Temple era seem to have had was far above that of the members of the First Temple. As we said, basically had Torah, their Oisik B'Torah, mitzvahs. The difficulty with with this is the fact that since time immemorial, the Jewish people have involved themselves with Torah study, not just now, not just previously in Europe, or in the times of the Tanoim, Vamoroyim, the authors of the Mishnah and Talmud, but from Jewry's infancy, the study of Torah, especially the oral law, the Torah Shebaal Peh, has been central to their lives. As we read, this is a short review here, number two, oral law. It first starts off, Moshe Kibbutz Torah Mesinai, Moses received the Torah at Sinai, transmitted to Joshua, Joshua to the elders, elders to the prophets to the men of the great assembly. There's an unbroken chain. And the Gemara in Bracha says that really the original Torah that was given, to, like we're speaking about Torah, the Torah was given referring to the oral law. The Levi Bar Chama says further in the name of Shim ben Lakish, what is the meaning of the verse? And I will give you tablets of stone and the law and the commandments which I have written that you may teach them. Tablets of stone, these are the Ten Commandments. The law, that's the Pentateuch, and I'm referring to Torah, the written Torah. The commandment, this is the Mishnah, which I have written, these are the prophets and the hagiographia. And thou, this, you may, and we teach them, this is the Gemara. And as Lohiroisam, the Gemara understands, is to guide them. That even if you know the facts of the Torah Shebaal Peh, but you have to have, understand how to apply it. It teaches that all these things were given to Moses on Sinai. So all of the Torah was given. And again, it was transferred from Moses all the way, generation after generation. Just there's one instance about, I think, Rabbi says, said, this is Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, said that this verse, you shall slaughter as I have commanded you. This is about how they're supposed to slaughter when you come to Israel. You're going to have, you'll need to eat meat. This is, slaughter as I commanded you. Kashati v'sicha. Teach that Moses was instructed concerning the gullets, the esophagus, and the windpipe, the kona. Concerning, says, the greater part of one of these organs that must be cut in the case of the bird, and the greater part of each in the case of cattle. I mean, just referring to the halacha, we know if they're slaughtering cattle, you have to slit both the majority of the windpipe and the esophagus. And by a bird, it says, even one would suffice. But all of these are included in Kasha Tzivisicha, like I commanded you. This assumption that I gave you specific guidelines how to do this, and the assumption is, I mean, the Jews are doing this now has been as part of this oral tradition. This is our rabbis talking more in Kedushin 37a. It says, you know, these are Chukim, Mishpatim. It says, these are the statutes. This refers to So the chukim over here, the Gemara understands this, are rules. It says, Ela chukim, elam hamidrashas. So that refers to the rabbinic interpretation. They're rules of interpretation. When you read a verse in the Chumash, you can see, says, what other ideas are embedded in them. And their judgments refers to civil law, which you shall observe. So the Gemara understands this is referring to the study of the Mishnah. Observing means to guard it, to make sure that it's not forgotten. And then to do is to actual practice. But the Gemara understands that initially, when Moshe commanded them, says he gave them the Torah Shebaal Peh, gave them the tools, and he gave them the laws, and he demanded, says that they have to put it to memory, commit it to memory, and to practice. We're quoting now on paragraph E. From the days of Moshe until Hillel, this is from a period, it's quoted in Sefer Krisus and the Machzor Vitri, but it's really from the Gaonic period. From the days of Moshe until Hillel, there were 600 orders of Mishnah. We have today only 6 orders of Mishnah. There were 600. Just as they were given to Moshe at Sinai. In other words, they preserved all of this. From Hillel and on, the world became impoverished, and the glory and power of Torah became diminished. Hillel and Shammai instituted a mere 6 orders. In other words, they condensed. the information in the 600 into the 6. These are the authorities, the men of the Mishnah. The masters from Hillel all the way to Nosson and Rabbi. These latter authorities were the last authorities of the Mishnah. But according to the Gaonim's understanding, is there was a much larger corpus that preceded even Hillel. And it was kept from generation to generation. There are people who dedicated themselves. And even during the period of the Tanoim, says there were still people, even after Hillel, who still mastered this 600. And that's why I quote on paragraph F. There's Mishana Ela Bale Mishnah, says it's referring, this is a verse in Isaiah. So he says, means the masters of the Mishnah, like Rehuda ben Tema and his colleagues. Rapapa and our rabbis dispute there, and one says there were 600 orders of the Mishnah, and the other that there were 700 orders of the Mishnah. Evidently, the time it was lost at the time of the time of the Amoraim, the authors of the Talmud. But there were people even in the Rehuda ben Tema, was like the time of Rabbi Akiva. So they were individuals who still remember them. Yeah, that's a different thing. That's a whole different thing. We're going to speak about it, but that's a different thing. But I'd say we see there's a vast. I mean, we speak about like the Shulchan Aruch. You know, like it's a very large amount of material. The Gemara in Tumura, Tesvovim Beis Design of Medallah, in 15b, says, we learned elsewhere, when Yosef ben Uezer of Tzareda and Yosef ben Yochanan of Yerushalayim died, the grape clusters, the scholars, Isha Eshkolos, came to an end. What is the meaning of Eshkolos? Which some Eshkol means a grape cluster. Means a man in whom all is contained, ish kol. In other words, it's really a contraction for the thing that he's a person who has everything. When Behuda reported the name of Shmuel, all the grape clusters, the Eshkolos, who arose from the day of Moses until Yosef ben Uezer learned Torah like Moses our teacher. It wasn't forgotten. From that time onward, they did not learn Torah like Moses our teacher. So the Gemara asks this question. But did not Rabbi Yehuda report the name of Shmuel? 3,000 halachas were forgotten during the period of mourning for Moses. So the Gemara answers, those laws which were forgotten. But those which were learned, they learned like Moses our teacher. In other words, they realized that there are 3,000 areas that was not clear. They've forgotten what did Moses say here. And the Gemara speaks about Asniel ben Knaz, the Hechzirim, the Pupula, who through logic, came to a conclusion of what they were, a reconstruction. But those that were preserved were preserved.
So the 3,000 were preserved?
There are millions, but the 3,000 were forgotten, but they knew which was forgotten.
And they got it back.
Perhaps we're going to see. Yeah. He got back, but we're going to see. But has it not been caught after the death of Moses? If those who pronounce unclean were in the majority, then the rabbis declare the object unclean. If those who pronounce clean were in the majority, then the rabbis declared it clean. I mean, tohor, like ritually clean. So you see that there were questions brought up, that not everything was memorized. So the Gemara says the Gemara's is a liba de imit. Their acumen diminished, but what they learned like Moses, our teacher. So the Rashi explains there that it's referring to those areas which they did not have a clear tradition because it had been forgotten. That was the area that they debated. So Asniel ben Knaz may have come to a conclusion, but others may have disagreed, or another based on disagreed, and that was these areas which were not, which didn't, they didn't have a clarity as a part of the of the unforgotten legacy, so to speak. But that which was remembered, as they knew, says they knew it all. It has been taught, he says, all the great clusters arose in Israel from the days of Moses until the day death of Yosef ben Uezer were free from all dofi, any taint. From that time on, some matter of taint was found in them. In other words, said Rav Yosef, the word dofi here means dispute. I mean, because there was a lack of clarity. More questions arose because it began forgetting. The dispute relating to laying on of hands, it's referring, this was the first major machlokas that really had no, did not have a any solution. Evidently, and this was not, it seems, this was not part of the original 3,000 forgotten. They had not, there was actually a new forgetting. But does not Yossi ben Uezer himself differ with reference to the law of laying off on of hands? You're saying that, I mean, he was part of those who, Yossi ben Uezer was part of those who were unclear. And he debated, this is others. When he so he says, when he differed, it was in his latter years when his acumen declined. But earlier, up until the end, towards the end of his death, he was clear exactly what had been given from Moshe. And then a new question, just like the 3,000 in the time of the death of Moshe, new questions arose. And that happened only at the end of the life of Yosef ben Uezer. To give you a sense of, so here we have at least, you know, the Gedoli Hador, the greats, kept the entire, you know, preserved the entire Torah. And it seems it isn't just by individuals. I just want to quote a Gemara here again, how the Gemara understands our history. There's a Gemara taken in Moran Sanhedrin and Memtesa Medallah from 49a. Then said the king to Amosa, the king is referring to King David, David HaMelech. Amosa was a general. And there was a problem that arose that they needed to call up all of the populace. And that's the, call me the men of Yehuda together within 3 days. So Amosa went to call the men of Yehuda together, but he tarried, etc. Yeah. And as a result, because he did not do do this quickly, Yoyev, who had been the general who was partially displaced because of this Amosa had been a general under Avshalom. Amosa was also a relative of David's, but he had been a general of Avshalom, who had conducted this rebellion against David. To make peace afterwards, after the rebellion was quelled, he took Amosa, made him a general. Yeah, I mean, Yoav was a general, but he really put him in charge. Yoav was deeply hurt or whatever. Yoav was the one actually he killed. Yoav, David did not feel good about it. He was the one who actually killed Avshalom, Yoav. He was caught by his hair in a tree. This is a famous story. David gave orders to Amosa to gather all these of Yehuda, these to form a troop. Because basically it was a citizen army. When there was a problem, then they were all called. It's like the Miluyim in Eretz Yisrael. So they, but he tarried, and as a result, Yoav came to him. He felt that he had violated the command. And therefore, Yoav killed Amosa. Before King David HaMelech died, this is not fair. We had before David HaMelech died, he charged Shlomo HaMelech. He says, "Take care of him. Take care of Yoav." He killed good men. He killed, it says Avner ben Ner, who had been the general of Shlomo HaMelech, Ishbosheth. Says, and he killed Amosa. Says, so take care of him. When Shlomo challenged Yoav and said, how could you kill Amosa? Kill a person in cold blood. So he said he had violated the command. But, said he, Shlomo HaMelech, Amos interpreted the particles, ach and rak, thus. Says the source where we know that one who is who does not keep the order of the king is put to death is in the first parak of Yoshua. In that sentence, it uses the word ach and rak. He told ach, usually when words ach, you know, however, and rak says, are used, they're interpreted, because they didn't have to be used, they're interpreted on the level of a drasha that it qualifies. It's not total. It's as if to say, it's true, but under certain circumstances. And there are circumstances that does not apply. He found them, says he went to gather the people, Amosa, and he found them as they had begun the study of a tractate. In other words, they began, it's like the Daf Yomi, and they're all starting brachas, stop bays. He can't, you know what I mean? He can't let them like first get into it. So he didn't want to disturb them. Whereupon he said, it is written, whosoever be that shall rebel against the king's commandments, and this is the verse in Yeshua, in Joshua, shall not hearken unto thy words in all that thou commandest him, he shall be put to death. Now, as one might have thought that this holds good even when the transgression is committed for the sake of the study of the law, it is therefore written only rak, rak chazak v'amatz, rak, be strong of good courage to do this, but using that term hints at the fact is that it is, that there are qualifications. And one of the qualifications is that you're not mevatel, the study of Torah to do, it supersedes the king's command. But what does it tell you from this? It seems the whole nation is sitting, and the people who would normally go to fight began the Daf Yomi again. In other words, they began the tractate. So it gives you a proof. What kind of people were they? This is the time of David HaMelech. And the quote says from another one, that this is David's general, Ben-Yoel Ben-Yoyada, was a tremendous scholar. You could look at yourself. But he was a tremendous scholar. I mean, we find scholarship that was not just in the Second Temple. And besides that, there was always a court system and trained judges to apply the Torah's teaching on a daily basis. Their place was in a special room at the gate of the city, so that those from the surrounding area could immediately come to the gateway of the city and have their problems received. And that's what we find this in Canaan Bishar, and this goes through all of Tanakh. The Torah speaks about this. Shoftim v'shoytrim titn l'cha, judges and officers you shall make, says, in all of your gates, which Hashem says, which the Lord your God gives you, throughout your tribes, and you shall judge the people with just judgment. We speak about the the halach of yibum, you know, the levirate marriage. A person dies without children. Again, who was the ones who were involved in this? If a man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders. And they're elders, it's assumed. There are judges. In the book of Ruth, Boaz, this is the last one, he wanted to take care of dealing with Ruth and then to deal with the redemption of the property. Then Boaz then went up to the gate and sat there down. And look, it says, because the gate was the place where things were judged. And then he took two of the men, he took 10 men of the elders of the city, sit down ye, and they sat down and they decided this issue. But here it says, this is a Canaan Bishar. And we spoke about Avshalom and his rebellion. So how did he went It was like a political, you know, how the political parties work over here. And he went and, you know, kissed babies, handed out this, leaflets. Avshalom rose up early and stood beside the way of the gate. And it was so that anyone who had a controversy came to the king for judgment. Then Avshalom called unto him and said, "Of what city are you?" He said, "This is." And he said, "The servant is one of the tribes of Israel." And this, "I have," says, I can help you. What do you have to go to the king for?" And Avshalom said, says, started showing the people, "I can, you know, I can do this. You don't have to go up to the king." And that's how he ingratiated himself to the populace. But again, he went to the gate. And almost the prophet says, "Hate the evil, love the good, and establish judgment in the gate." And when Yirmiyahu says in Echo, in Lamentations, says the elders, what the total destruction of Jerusalem, the elders have ceased from the gates. Because understand, they were always judges. It was always Torah. We have a whole tradition of Torah. So again, we have to ask ourselves then, again, in other words, the first temple was also filled with Torah scholars, with in fact greater knowledge than those of the second. Because within the second, in the time of Yosef ben Uezer and on, then the thing started devolving. So what was so special about the Torah scholars of the second temple period? It's important to note that although idolatry was a scourge of the first temple period, for the most part, as Rashi points out in his commentary to Chulin and Dalet Amud Beis in 4b, even the idolaters practiced the Torah, kept Shabbos and Kashrus, the laws of Taras HaMishpacha, says ritual purity, in the form that Moshe Rabbeinu taught them as part of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law. In the second temple period, there rose a new sect of Jews who challenged the whole rabbinic tradition. The Talmud refers to them as Sadukim and Baisusim, named after the founders of their respective sects, who originally were Talmidim disciples, the founders of Antigonus of Socho, the disciple of Shimon HaTzadik, a member of the courts as of Ezra and Nehemiah, of the Anshe Knesset HaGdolah. So they were Talmidim of Antigonus, who was a Talmud of Shimon HaTzadik, who was part of the greater group of scholars that was led by Ezra, Nehemiah. And this is how the Medrash of us, Rabbi Nosson, described the beginning of these sects. Antigonus, the man of Socho, is in the bottom, had two disciples that studied and repeated his words and repeated them to their disciples, who in turn taught it to their disciples. They, the disciples, arose and analyzed their words and commented, "How could our forefathers ever make such a statement, that one should serve Hashem without the motivation of receiving a reward? Is it possible that a laborer should not receive his wages at night? If our forefathers were aware of another world and the resurrection of the dead, they would have never made such a statement. They arose and severed their ties to the Torah. Two breaches came out from them, the Sadducees, Sadducim, the self-styled disciples of Tzaddik, one of Antigonus' disciples, and by Susim, the self-styled disciples of Baisus, another disciple. Throughout their lives at Sadducim, the Sadducees would use only the finest vessels of silver and gold. They were gross and arrogant people. They would often say that the Pharisees have a tradition to torment themselves in this world without having anything in the next." They didn't believe in another world, the Sadducees. There's only one world. All the reward is in this world. This is how Josephus, in his work Antiquities, describes them. Now, Josephus never mentions the Baisusim, but he does mention a third sect, another third group besides the Perushim, the Pharisees of the Rabbonim, and the Sadducees, which he calls the Essenes, Essens, or the Essenes. And it's quite likely the Essenes are actually the Baisusim mentioned in Talmudic literature. It seems, though, that although both the Sadducees and the Essenes were opposed to the Pharisees of Perushim, the name given to the rabbis of that time because of their separation, precious, from the masses, due to the masses' lack of commitment to the laws of ritual purity, These sects were quite different, as we read from the following passage from Josephus' work here. At this time, this Antiquities in Book 13. At this time, there were three sects amongst the Jews who had different opinions concerning human actions. The one was called the sect of the Pharisees, another the sect of the Sadducees, the other the sect of the Essenes. Now, for the Pharisees, they say that some actions, but not all, are the work of fate, and some of them are in our own power, and that they are that they are liable to fate, but are not caused by fate. In other words, there's free will. There's not free will for everything. There's ashkocha, there's providence, but by and large, you are given free will. But the sect of the Essenes affirm that fate governs all things, that nothing befalls man but what is according to its determination, which really took away the whole idea of free will. I mean, the same problem you find the Rambam describes by Muslims, and we find in the early Protestant movement, the Luther. And for the Sadducees, they take away fate and say there's no such thing, and that the events of human affairs are not at its disposal. But they suppose that all our actions are in our own power. We ourselves are cause of what is good and receive what is evil from our own folly. In other words, Hashem is not involved in the world unless to punish whatever it is. But he lets these free, total free reign. However, I've given a more exact account of these opinions in the second book of the Jewish War. Okay, now this is the quote from the Jewish War, this part of it. This is in Book 2, Chapter 8. But the Sadducees are those that compose the second order and take away fate entirely and suppose that God is not concerned in our doing or not doing what is evil. And they say that to act what is good or what is evil is at man's own choice, and that the one or the other belongs so to everyone, so they may act as they please. They also take away the belief of the immortal duration of the soul and the punishments and reward in Hades and Gehenna. Moreover, the Pharisees are friendly to one another and for the exercise of concord and regard for the public. But the behavior of the Sadducees one towards the other is in some degree wild, and their conversations with those that are of their own party is as barbaric as they were as if they were strangers to them. And this is what I have to say concerning the philosophical sects amongst the Jews. And they're basically kofrim. You know, they basically, really deny everything. I mean, this is at least how we have from Joseph. God doesn't care. I mean, it's hard to read that. And they claim they believe in the Torah Shebiktav, the written one. The Torah Shebiktav clearly says that God is his concern and he punishes. Now, eventually, the Tzedukim became a dominant force in Israel. The Gemara in Kedushin describes how this came about. And this is let me summarize this. You can take... you can look at this yourself. There was a question of the yichus, the purity of Yochanan, who was called Yanai in the Gemara and Kedushin, who was the son of Shimon, the last surviving son of Matthisyahu of the Hanukkah story. The Matthisyahu had five sons. The last surviving one was Shimon. They were all killed. He escaped. There was a plot against him, against Shimon, by Shimon's son-in-law. Yochanan escaped. And initially, it seems he was with the Pharisees, with the Prushim, with the Rabbonim. But eventually, he turned into a Sadducee. And what the catalyst, what generated this, was that they were a family of Kohanim, Matthisyahu. We say in the Alanisim, Matthisyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol. They were a family of Kohanim, a priest. Now, a priest has certain limitations about the woman that he can marry. And there had been a rumor that Shimon's wife had been taken captive by Antiochus' men during the time, the breakdown, during which we did. You know, and during this time, you know, during the breakdown of law and order, so to speak, and the Greek soldiers were there in the country, she had been taken captive. And had she had relations against her will, with a Greek soldier, it would render her that she could not remain with her husband, nor if there were subsequent children, they would be disqualified from the kahuna. And there was such a rumor about her. Someone had mentioned this rumor. There was a party, you can read this, at the party, someone slipped and told him, says, you know, this Yanai, Yochanan, was wearing the tzitz. It is a front plate of gold that's written Kodesh Lashem. And he was wearing this.
Is it gold or silver?
It's gold. Yes, it's a golden front plate. And someone slipped and said, you know, it's good enough that you run this government. You're the king. You don't need to be a kohen as well. And it was based on this, on the rumor that had gone around. Well, afterwards, they had done more research about the rumor and found it didn't have a basis. And the king was furious, and he had an advisor who was a Sadducee and hated the Rabbonim, and said, they took action, the Rabbonim, about this person who cast aspersions on Yanai, and they had excommunicated him, whatever. And they told this advisor told Yanai, so they didn't do enough. They really don't like you. And with that, he decided to join the Sadducees. And he killed out the majority, it seems, of the Rabbonim. And it was under those circumstances that the leader of the Pharisees, Yeshua ben Prachya, ran away to save himself and ran away to Alexandria. But this, from that point on, the subsequent kings, were basically all Sadducees. Until finally they were destroyed, they were taken over by Herod, who was a, this is a story in itself. But the Sadducees had tremendous hatred towards the Persian. Josephus, in his work, Antiquities of the Jews, tells, like I said, you can look at this. The historian tells a very similar story. But it's evident the way he tells the story, in his own writings, that it's evident he had a personal vendetta against the Pharisees as well. Even though he claimed that he was, he's really part of the Pharisees, but he really has, whenever he writes about the Pharisees, it's very condescending and very critical. Now, at the end of the 19th century, a Geniza, a storage area of old manuscripts dating back to the first millennium, was discovered in the Ben Ezra Synagogue in Fustat, Old Cairo. And much of the material was subsequently published. Amongst the finding was a copy of a much older work called the Damascus Covenant. The authors of this document seem to have been connected to a cult which flourished in the Second Temple period based in Qumran, near the Dead Sea in Eretz Israel, whose writings were discovered nearby. These cultic writings made up a large part of the so-called Dead Sea Scrolls. This cult also seems to be connected to the Essenes. Now, again, you can read this yourself here. But he says, when they speak about, if you look in the bold print, that how they look at themselves, they're the chosen people, and all the other people are sinners. And he says, For they sought smooth things, dorshe halokos, which is again, which is a play on words of dorshe halokos. Now there's smooth things, and they preferred illusions, and they watched for breaks, pirtzes. In other words, rabbinic legislation is based on, just like all legislation in our legislature, if there are problems in society, to fix them. So they watched for breaks and chose the fair neck, and then they justify the wicked and condemn the just. Condemn the just means they consider themselves just. They transgress the covenant, violated the precept. The Pharisees. They banded together against the life of righteousness and loathed all who walked in perfection, referring to them. Like this was an ascetic community. They pursued them with the sword and exulted in the strife of the people, and the anger of God was kindled against their congregation so that he ravaged all their multitude. Their deeds were defilement before him. And we know during the time of Yanai, this is the second Yanai, this is the son Yanai, the son of Yochanan. In other words, there's Matthisiohu, his son Shimon, his son Yochanan, and now his son Janaeus, Alexander Janaeus, Yanai. So this Yanai also pursued the Pharisees. And it seems that this is an allusion to that. But there were tremendous ill will. This is between these various sects. Now notice all of the hatred against rabbinic establishment spews from this document. Now besides the Sadducees and Essenes, but by Susim, the masses of Jews on the whole look to the Pharisees or Rabbanim for guidance, seems to also have a love-hate relationship with them. But I would like just to give you a sense of what Josephus felt about them. This is Josephus. For there was a certain sect of men that were Jews, and he looks at it like a separate sect. I mean, these were the Rabbanim, the sect of Jews who valued themselves highly upon the exact skill that they had in the law of their fathers, and made men believe they were highly favored by God. Evidently, you see from the way he said this, what his opinion was. By whom this set of women, this is in the middle of this thing, this was in the time of Herod. The set were inveigled. These are those that are called the sect of the Pharisees, who are in a capacity of greatly opposing kings. A cunning sect they were, and soon elevated to a pitch of open fighting and doing mischief. Accordingly, when all the people of the Jews gave assurance of their goodwill to Caesar and to the king's government, these very men did not swear, being above 6,000. So he gives us a number of who were the Rabbanim. There were 6,000 called Pharisees. And when the king Herod imposed a fine upon them, Pharaoh's wife paid their fine for them. But he seems, again, he took, much of the history during the period of Herod was taken from a work by an advisor of Herod, Nicholas of Damascus. So it's indicative of the fact he quoted him verbatim is indicative of how he held of them as well. And it gives you a sense of how many were them. And then he describes the Pharisees in another part of his Antiquities. Pharisees were one of the sects of the Jews, as we have informed you already. These have so great a power over the multitude that when they say anything against the king or against the high priest, they are presently believed. So it's indicative, not just of Josephus' attitude, but it's indicative that they were the ones who were respected by the people. They were the Rabbanim. These were the rabbis. And it speaks of he gives the number, if we can assume it's right, 6,000. But the rest of the people were not Rabbanim. They were hardworking people, and they looked to the Rabbanim for their guidance. However, just as we see in Josephus, there was a certain, even though they followed their dictates, but it seems the ignorant masses harbored greatest hostility towards the Pharisees. And this is what we find as the Gemara in Pesachim, this is in Memtesam and Beis, it was taught, Rabbi Kiva said, when I was in Amoritz, I said, I would like to take a scholar before me, I would maul him like a donkey. Said his disciples to him, says, Rebbe, say like a dog. So no, the former bites and the donkey bites and breaks the bones. While the latter, the dog bites but does not break the bones. He answered them. It was taught where Eliezer said, but that we are necessary to them for trade, they would kill us. Greater is the hatred wherewith the Amei Haoretz hate the scholar than the hatred wherewith the heathens hate Israel. And their wives, says of the Amayorites, of the unlettered, says, hate even more than they. It was taught, he who had studied and then abandoned the Torah hates the scholar more than all of them. So we're seeing that there was an awful lot of hatred here. According to the Tosfos and Ksubas in Samar Beis, on Beis 62b, it was because the common people interpreted the separation of the Rabbonim from the masses, which was based upon their concern for ritual purity, to be a sign of arrogance, like, we're not good enough for you. By the way, this animosity between the Pharisees and the common folk is richly evident in the New Testament. So much so that the word Pharisee in the English language is defined as someone self-righteous or hypocritically devout. At this point, I'd like to return to the Gemara Numa and Tess on the Bays, which we previously quoted. Again, he says, but why was the Second Temple destroyed? Seeing that in time they were occupying themselves with Torah, observing precepts and practice of charity, because therein prevailed hatred without cause, that the groundless hatred is considered as if of even gravity the three sins of idolatry, immorality, and bloodshed together. Now, knowing the general state of affairs during this period, it seems clear that these 6,000-some Pharisees, despite what was happening in general society, would have prevented the destruction of the Second Temple, or perhaps brought about the construction of the Third Temple, simply because of their piety. We know the scholars of the First Temple were guilty of not having protest against the sinners of that generation, as we see from the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. And the Gemara says that from the previous lecture, that even though those who were killed, many were killed, were guiltless. They kept the Torah from Aleph till Tov. But yet, since they didn't protest, they're not considered completely guiltless. Because the Gemara says over here that Avram Avinu, the Abraham, is pleading to Hashem, you can't kill innocent people. Like it's a Chil Hashem. The profanation of your name. So he says, yeah. And he says that, therefore he's pleading for the people of Sodom. He said, if they're innocent people, it would be terrible to kill them. So the Gemara asked, but what happened by the temple? You have all these innocent people. Yeah, but they could have protested. And that's what we discussed last week. But it's also clear from that Gemara, as well as the Gemara in Shabbos in 55a, which you quote in the previous lecture, that their merits would not have saved the temple, perhaps only themselves. Because originally he wanted to destroy the temple and the tzaddikim to spare. He would spare the tzaddikim, and then because they had not, it brought to attention how the Gemara describes it, that they had not protested, then even the tzaddikim, the saintly, the righteous people, were also killed. But it seems even initially, before everything, that they would have not had the ability to save the generation, only themselves. This, I believe, is the subject of the following passage from the Gemara Nedorim in 81. And this, I think, is crucial to understanding this. Rav Yehuda said in Rav's name, what is meant by, it says in Pasuk Yirmiyahu, who is the wise man that he understands this? For what is the land destroyed, etc.? Like, the Yirmiyahu said, what happened here? Why is the land being destroyed? Now, this question was put to the sages, prophets, and ministering angels, but they cannot answer it. Until the Almighty Himself did so, as is written, and the Lord said, because they have forsaken my law, which I set before them, have not obeyed my voice, neither walked therein. But is not, have not obeyed my voice, I dealt with, neither walked therein? Rav Yehuda said in Rav's name, it means they did not first recite a benediction over the Torah. They learned Torah. They couldn't understand. It was full of Torah. We said before, they were all learning Torah. Why was the Beis HaMikdash destroyed?
The first one.
Why was the first one destroyed? And the answer was, well, when they learned, they didn't say a bracha beforehand. Which Rabbeinu Nissen, in his commentary to that Gemara in the Dorim, quotes the Rabbeinu Yonah, who says it's really indicative that they did not study Torah for its own sake. They didn't view it as holy. It was an occupation. Everyone's doing it. They do it. You know, you find, it's a thing that you can get honor. You have a place in society. You're recognized. But they did not do it for lishma. They didn't do it for its own sake. And here you find the prophets. Here's Jeremiah and Yirmiyahu says, the priests do not say, where's the Lord? This is the critique of them in the period before the destruction of the first temple. And though they who hold on to the Torah says, know me not. The rulers also transgressed against me, and the prophets prophesied by Baal and walked after things they did not benefit. But he said, those who hold on to the Torah, Tovsei Torah, are referring to the scholars. Says, know me not. They don't know me. In other words, it's not God's Torah that they're studying. It isn't a way of being dovek, close to God. And the Radak explains, those who hold on to the Torah, these are students of Torah. Know me not. They did not study the Torah for its own sake, in order to fulfill that which was written in it. Rather, they study with their lips and not with their heart. This is the meaning of they knew me not. For proper thoughts and proper actions are its, not quote unquote, its knowledge, like to know. And not just learning alone. Targum Yonason translated, the teachers of Torah didn't teach them to know, to be in awe of me. So they were scholars, but there was something very, it seems to be critical, that was missing from them. But for those who truly live a spiritual life and study Torah lishma for its own sake, the whole world was made for their sake. As we read here, there's a Gemara. The Gemara quotes here, the Gemara in Brachos in 6b. What is the meaning of the Ecclesiastes? It says, fear God and keep His commandments, gezeh kol odom, for this is the whole man, the whole of man. So Rabbi Elazar said, the Holy One, blessed be He, says, the whole world's created for His sake only. Why did God create the world? It says to produce people like that. Rav Abba Bar Kahana says He is equal in value to the whole world. He's one man, but He's worth. He's equal in value to the whole. The numbers don't count. His quality is equivalent to all to the cumulative quality of mankind. Shimon ben Azai said, since Shimon ben Zalma, the whole world was created as an accompaniment for Him. In other words, really, He is the one that the whole world is revolves around. And everything else is He needs to live in a world, so he needs the people. But He is the Iker, the pious one. It seems then that the Pharisees, the Torah scholars, the Talmid Chacham of that generation, not only did they protest the ills of others, which is well documented in the writings of the early Christians, They didn't make the mistake of the scholars during the First Temple period. They protested. That's why there was so much animosity. They protested. But had they not only protest, but learn Torah on the highest level, the Shema. Yeah, so he says, it seems that they not only protested, but they learned Torah. This is on the highest level. The Oisik B'Torah, there was no Taina, there was no critique on the Torah that they learned. They learned Torah on the highest level, the Shema. More so than those of the first temple. So, and for that, I understand is what's meant by the previously quoted passage. They were the Oisik, but they were involved in Torah study, observance of precepts, and the practice of charity. They were all well-meaning. So you had Torah, the Taina that we says, they asked why the first temple was destroyed. And he says, because of the people, there's so many people learning Torah, but there was something lacking in the Torah. These people, their Torah was not lacking. So they had all the ma'if. So why was the temple destroyed, not replaced with a third temple? In other words, they themselves should have turned around the whole generation. The answer, I believe, is related to the following passage from Tosfos and Sochem. Now, just as a hagdoma, it's important to note. When they speak about sinas chinam, they had gratuitous hatred. Who were they hating? We know the Sadducees hated them. We know the Essenes hated them. We know the common folk hated them. It seems amongst themselves, though, the Gemara and Yevomus and the Yedalah and Beis in 14b, they had Ava Vareus. That's how the Gemara. Like, they had love, friendship. In the same language we wish of. Shabora, Gila, Rina, Ava. They had it. Even Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, who were opposed on many issues. And then sometimes it became passionate. But amongst them, intermarried amongst themselves. It doesn't seem that the Pharisees within themselves had this hatred. So who did they have a hatred to? It was to those that hated them. Because the Sadducees and the Essenes and the real multitude of people had harbored such ill will towards them, they themselves got caught up in this and hated them back. And this is really, we're quoting now from a Tosfos. Here, in Sochem, I think it's very crucial in understanding, in Kufyud Gimel and Beis in 113b. The Gemara said before, if I see someone who deliberately does something which is forbidden, it's immoral, I see him doing an Avera, and he's warned, he knows it's wrong, and he does it anyway, he's doing it b'mezid, he's doing it willfully. I'm allowed, but nobody else knows about this. I'm not allowed to go to the courts and tell them, because I'm only an eid echad, I'm one witness. They can't act on this, and it's considered lashon hara. In fact, if somebody, the Gemara describes that someone went to the courts and he gave such testimony, and this witness was flogged, because you can't believe it. It's not substantive. And all you're doing is just saying lashon hara. However, but if I see him, I can't tell the courts, but I'm allowed to hate him. Hate means I'm allowed to distance myself from him, to dislike him. So Tosfos asks, so when the Gemara explains the verse, that if you see the donkey, the animal of your enemy that's in distress, you're supposed to help them. Your enemy is referring to such a person. A normal person, you're not allowed to have enemies. You're supposed to love other Jews. Here's a person you're allowed, or maybe even a mitzvah to dislike. So Tosfos asks the question here, and he says, it's stated in Bov Metzian 32b, in Lama Bezon Bez, that one sees the animal of his friend toiling under an extra heavy load, and needs to be unloaded. Well, at the same time, he sees the load of an animal of his enemy laying on the ground, which needs to be reloaded on top of the animal. The animal here is not in distress. So normally, everything else being equal, both need to go to market, both have to be helped. But the one, this animal's in distress, you have the problem the animal itself could be injured, and the animal is suffering, and you'd go and help the animal in distress. But in this situation, says so you go and help, the first one you help is the one who needs to be reloaded, the enemy here. It is a mitzvah requirement for him to load the animal of the enemy before unloading the animal of his friend, in order for him to subdue his evil inclination. That's what the Gemara says. So Tosfos asks the question, what do you mean evil inclination? The Gemara says you're allowed to hate him. Maybe a mitzvah to hate him or to dislike him. In the light of the Gemara and Pesachim, however, that is either allowed or required to dislike such a wicked person, this emotion is not the product of evil inclination. Tosfos then answers, since he shows his dislike towards his associate will in turn hate him, as it says, as in water, the face reflected in water is a copy to the face that shows itself to the water. So does the heart of man to man. You look in the water, you see your reflection. There's a person feels naturally, says like you, the light rays hit the water and go back, the person feels the vibrations of either like or dislike. He feels it and it goes back. In other words, you feel you're in the presence of someone who does not like you. It creates a feeling of dislike. As a result, the personal dislike of the enemy will be reflected back, so that eventually it will lead to simple, unjustified hatred. In other words, I dislike them because he's not a moral person or whatever it is. So I kept my distance. But now that he's reflective hatred towards me, sees me, I don't like him. And it becomes now he doesn't like me. Now I hate him back. And it now becomes more intense, my hatred. Originally it's a rachmanis, you know what I mean? You know, I'm going to keep far away from such a person. But now, it says, it becomes personal. Because the other person picked it up. Now you don't like me, huh? No, so then he really becomes intensely, he disclosed his hatred, just like the Amaratzim did. When you feel being hated, you start hating back. Consequently, the subduing of the evil inclination is applicable for that level of hatred. That's why the law is that one should go and help your enemy. Because there may be the original kernel of the dislike may be justified, but it has layers upon layers that have to be removed. And it seems to me that what happened here, you know, is that they, because of the intense hatred and how the whole society fell apart, whereas even the tzaddikim, they were really tzaddikim, talmidei chachamim, to mitzvahs, they learned Torah lishma, they learned Torah for its own sake, they were involved in chesed, they were fine, wonderful people, but the flaw that they had was that they hated the other. And it wasn't the other just because it was a dislike you want to keep away from these people. But it was a personal hatred. And we see this in the story, the famous story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. As you can read this, you know, it's a famous story that this fellow who seems to be in a Sadducee was shamed at a banquet. The Rabbonim were sitting there. They did nothing. And as a result, he became so angry, as Bar Kamsa, that he brought about what eventually led to the destruction of the temple. But it was because it's just indicative of the hatred that existed then, which led to all of this. Now, I mean, this, I believe, is why Sinas Chinam is so devastating. So he says, if you see the Gemara, what is, in other words, had the Chachamim, they're wonderful people, had they all been like Hillel, you know, in the bottom of the page, Hillel used to say, says be heavy, says Metamidiv Shal Aaron, says Oyev Shalom, Roidev Shalom, love peace, pursue peace, love your fellow, love his fellow creature, fellow man, and brings them close to the Torah. If all of these 6,000 plus people would all be like Hillel, says we wouldn't have had what happened. For care, these people would have been the masses of people generally. Were from people. They weren't maybe so careful, but they were basically, they looked up to the Rabbanim. So they would have tremendous influence upon them. The whole generation would be different. But as it stood, it says that they viewed, says the Rabbanim, says in less than stellar role, and it brings to light really what constitutes Chilul Hashem. The Gemara in Yuman, Pei Vav Amud Aleph. In page 15, we bring this paragraph G. Abai says it was taught, you shall love the Lord your God, that the name of heaven be beloved because of you. If someone studies scripture and Mishnah, and attends the disciples of the wise, is honest in business, and speaks pleasantly to persons, what do people then say concerning him? Happy the father who taught him Torah, happy the teacher who taught him Torah. Woe unto people who have not studied the Torah, for this man has studied the Torah. Look how fine his ways are, how righteous his deeds. Of him the scriptures say, and he said unto me, you are my servant Israel, for whom I will be glorified. But if someone studies scripture and Mishnah, attends to the disciples of the wise, but is dishonest in business, and discourteous in his relations with people, what do people say about him? Woe unto him who studied the Torah, woe unto his father who taught him Torah. Woe unto his teacher who taught him Torah. This man studied the Torah. Look how corrupt are his deeds, how ugly his ways. Of him scripture says, in that man said of them, these are the people of the Lord, and they are gone forth out of his land. They may be the people of the Lord, but they're condemned to exile because they don't live the life that is expected of them. I believe, just to summarize, we ask the question, the impression we have from the Second Temple period is everyone was wonderful, and it was because of this Sinas Chinam that it was destroyed. We ask the question twofold. First of all, Sinas Chinam itself doesn't seem to be such a terrible crime. It's bad, but it doesn't seem to be so terrible. And yet it's equated, the Gemara equates it, Sinas Chinam, the unjustified hatred of the Second Temple period to the immorality, the idolatry, murder of the First Temple. We had that problem. We had a problem also. It seems that maybe murder was rife, immorality was rife, even in the Second Temple period. So they don't seem to have been so great. And we said even the Pharisees, those who study Torah, it was just some 6,000 of them. I mean, it was like the great scholars. So, so how do we understand the Gemara? My understanding is they were talking great people, and they studied Torah Lishmo for its own sake, and it's just like the Gemara asked the question, why was the First Temple, why was it destroyed? Why did we go into exile in the First Temple period? Because the Torah didn't protect them, because they had not... the Torah didn't protect the whole populace because there was something lacking in the Torah. That lack was not in the Second Temple period. In that sense, they were superior. Even though they had all learned, they were superior. The problem was because the Sinas Chinam, I believe, was the Chilul Hashem. It was a desecration that the people who normally looked, these are the Rabbanim, and they believed in Torah, and they believed in the Torah Shebaal Peh. They believed in all of this. But they couldn't. They had a very bad feeling towards the Rabbanim, and that was the reason. That's why the people could not. They couldn't be elevated. And the original sins, we said, it was destined to last for this 420 years. The first was 70, and the 420 had all of their sins been expiated, and they said they'd gone away. Well, it didn't. It didn't happen. But the reason it didn't happen is because of this Sinas Chinam. Because they could not have that influence on the masses, and therefore the people went their way. And I believe that was really is the true tragedy of the of what occurred during the first, during the Second Temple period. So it's a really different way of looking at it as you normally look at this. But I see that the you know, the followers of the early Christians were of these Amaratzim. I mean, these were these unlettered people. These were his followers, the Yeshu's followers. And the ill will that they had, you know, even on one hand they looked at them, they're scholars, and they were knowledgeable. But on the other hand, the ill will that prevented them from becoming the people that they should have, and therefore the sins accumulated and were forced into, the temple was destroyed and were forced into exile. Are there any questions? Well, yeah.
Can you go back to the beginning? I'm trying to understand what the role of the second temple was, just understanding that it was sort of a pending situation.
Yeah, the role of the second temple period was, it was really, they were destined to go into Golus, not just 70 years, but for 490 years. Except the level of Golus, that the second level was a lesser level than the first one. It was a Golus. They were under the oppression of those nations, but it gave them a chance to grow. They had a temple.
So the sort of reduced quality they submitted was supposed to facilitate this?
That's right. That's right. And there's still a temple, so they could grow with the temple. You know, one of the reasons, you know, we bring that in a 6 year cycle, and then there's a seventh year, but there are 6 years, three threes. So 4 of those 6 years, a tenth of the produce is brought up to Yerushalayim, or its monetary equivalent is brought up to Yerushalayim. And the Tosfos in Bava Basra, in Chavala, you know, quotes the Sifri. That says the reason is because they'll be in Yerushalayim, they'll be near the temple, they'll be the Talmid Chachamim, and it says, and they're in Yerushalayim, they'll be uplifted. So having a temple was part of the process of uplifting them, and they should reach this atonement. So they had the suffering on one hand, but they had the temple on the other hand. And it says, but it didn't, because of this was the factor that it didn't work. Okay, a good tavach.